When it comes to investing, retirement, taxes, healthcare, and estate planning, the decisions you make today can greatly affect the quality of life for you and your loved ones tomorrow. What you need is straight and unbiased information on the most important issues you'll face when planning for your retirement and financial future. Good news! You found Premier Retirement Radio with Jeff Fogan. Jeff is the founder of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management, and he's been guiding people financially and into retirement for 30 years. So get ready for an hour of the most comprehensive financial information on the radio. Premier Retirement with Jeff Fogan. And now here's Jeff Fogan and Jeff Shade.
Thank you so much. Welcome to Premier Retirement with Jeff Fogan, the radio show that gives you the straight talk and honest answers you need to help you reach your wealth management and retirement goals through smart investing and careful planning. My name's Jeff Shade, and as always, I'm just here to ask the questions. But of course, the words of wisdom and solid advice, they come from Jeff Fogan, founder and president of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management. Hey, Jeff, how you doing this fine April weekend?
Well, hey, Jeff, to you. I'm doing great.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, yeah, I said April weekend. It's hard to believe, though, that we're in the second quarter already. Nevertheless, I wanted to start off by talking about the fact that we're in the second quarter here. Stocks have started the quarter slowly, and that may be a little concern for the Fed. What's your take on this?
I don't think there's any concern for the Fed. I think the market's finally seeing through the lying through their teeth they're doing at the Fed level, and I don't know. It's just the BS is beyond comprehension. Well, not really. It's not beyond comprehension. It's just beyond belief. I think that our government entities should spew a little bit more truth, and they do. For example, back in even November, December, I was shaking my head, and you can go back and re-listen to the shows where I say that it doesn't seem like they can really lower rates. I don't know why, you know, the Fed, you know, Jerome Powell says in the end of October, 1st of November, after the market's been tanking for 3 or 4 months, went down 10 or 15%, depending on what index you look at. And, you know, people get a little bit worried about all those, you know, gains in the first of the year, you know, that we're getting some of that losses from 2022 back. They kind of ran out of quantitative easing, which was the fake money that, well, they've been quantitative tightening, supposedly taking money out of the economy, right? Raising interest rates so they can get this inflation problem under control. So inflation is still running pretty high, a lot higher than they want, even though the numbers are coming down over the last 6 or 8 months from a year-to-year basis than they did a year ago, because from a year ago, they were going up, you know, 7, 8, 9% on a year-to-year basis. Then they were already up, and they're still going at a pretty good clip on top of that. But, you know, 2.8, 3.8, you know, 4%, 2.5, supposedly, year to year, if they massage the numbers just right. But then they always come out with a revised number the next month that says, oh no, we were really up a little higher. Well, inflation numbers had stopped growing as fast. And so they were actually not decreasing. We weren't getting anything like disinflation, anything given back from the inflation. The inflation was still happening. In fact, even 2%, which is the rate they want to get to, is still compounding on top of, you know, an already 17, 18, 19, 20% cost of living increase if you look at everything over the last couple of years. So 2 years ago, a 2% rate increase would have been 2% on whatever it was at that time. If you add another 20% to it, 2% on top of that is, it's actually increasing twice as fast, right? It's increasing a lot more. You know, there's another 2% on top of the 20. So that's another, you know, half a percent or so. So we've got to get that under control. And it hasn't been under control. In fact, the Fed finally decided, you know what, we're going to pause interest rates. Well, it gave the market a little bit of gas. Everybody's excited. Oh man, if they pause, you know, maybe companies start making money again. Because last year, even though the market was going up, corporate profits really were not. In fact, we finally got all through this last, the first quarter of this year, we finally got all the earnings for the last quarter of last year, which came in pretty much negative. They actually were not good. So on the news, you hear all these, oh, we had a robust earnings seasons because what? Meta had increase in earnings because they fired a whole bunch of people and stopped building the metaverse and just sold ads for a while so they could look like they were profitable. But, you know, their revenues were down and their R&D was down and their, you know, employee expenses were down. So it all looked really good from a standpoint of PE ratio of price earnings. And, you know, the stock goes up. They have all these stories, these, you know, two or three stories to tell. You know, Nvidia went crazy. But by and large, the S&P 500 was down the last quarter. They are not increasing earnings. Earnings were basically flat last year. I think the final numbers came in. I've seen a number as high as 1.4% growth in earnings last year. I also saw one that said 0.8% growth in earnings. So, you know, not sure what parameters they're using or, you know, what factors they're taking out of growth. Maybe one's inflation adjusted. I don't know. But anyway, we're looking at still somewhere around 1% growth last year in earnings, yet the market goes up 30%. starting to rebound in November. Back to my story. Sorry about the full circle here.
It's okay.
But in November, they say, okay, we're not going to raise interest rates anymore. And for about 3 weeks, the market goes crazy because everybody's given, you know, hype. Oh, we're going to lower. We're going to lower. And then the rest of the Fed chairman, I remember, who is it? John Williams in New York says, wait, well, I don't know. We never really thought about pausing. We might have to hold them up for a while because inflation is not really getting under control. Well, then a month later, the market, you know, is ready for another rate increase in December because we put them on pause in November. Instead, Powell comes out because the November to remember was really only 3 weeks long. That last week in November, it looked like the market was going to roll over and start going down again. Now, we really need to finish the correction that started in 2022, in my opinion. It should be about a 50% correction, getting back to normal values. But it got interrupted by a bunch of cash infusion from the Fed back in, you know, when the banks were going out to try to save the banks, and the banks just bought stock, made it go up till October. They said, we're going to put everything on hold. So November went crazy because everybody thought, yay, the market's going to get all better now and inflation's going to go to 2% by itself. And Powell says, it's all good. Well, the other Fed people said, maybe not. December comes, he says, oh, you know what? The market's running out of gas, but all the banks need to make their stock go up so they can get their big fat bonuses because, you know, bank presidents, which are essentially the broker dealers, the big broker dealers, you know, Merrill Lynch's, Bank of America, et cetera, JP Morgan, Chase JP Morgan, Jamie Dimon is not a banker. He is a broker dealer, one of the biggest. And, they all get their bonuses and pay is in stock, right? So they're not going to loan that money out that they're given. They're going to be basically trying to pump the market with that money. Instead of loaning that money and building the economy, they're buying their own stock, trying to pump their own bonuses and kind of insider trading in a way. They're putting their money into their own stocks. They're putting their money into NVIDIA and a few stocks in the S&P to make it look like the market goes up because the market is cap weighted. Meaning if you buy the Magnificent Seven and they make up 25 or 30% of the entire market capitalization of the entire market, only 5 to 7 stocks make up, you know, like a fourth of the market, then you could buy just those stocks and it looks like the market's going up, even though 97% of the stocks or 490 plus stocks on a net basis going up at all. In fact, more going down than going up. So this is what's happening. Come December, they say, we're running out of gas. Let's give them another BS. Let's say we're going to lower interest rates next year for about 3 times. And so all of a sudden the market goes, yay, they're going to lower interest rates. Yeah, that's going to be great for the market because if companies can borrow at lower rates, you know, they can bank bigger profits. It's going to give us a lot more confidence. Companies can hire better, blah, 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 blah. Well, I don't know. Lowering interest rates 2 or 3 quarter points doesn't make that big of a difference. But again, it's all predicated on getting inflation under control. All the while, we have an uptick in inflation while this is happening. Yet Powell says, I think we're going to have maybe up to 3 next year because we think we've got inflation under control. And I'm looking around thinking, where's inflation under control? It's still higher than they want. The other Fed chairs are also, wait a minute. We never talked about Fed any decreases in interest rates. We only talked about maybe holding pat for a little while, but for longer. And then right on the tail of Jerome Powell saying maybe 3, then you get Jamie Dimon and other big, all the bankers are saying, well, we think there's going to be 6 or 7. And, you know, everybody from, you know, big companies, Nationwide, Citigroup, Morgan Stanley, everybody is saying, yeah, we think there's going to be 6 or 7 rate decreases, and that puts the fair market value of the stock market 30% higher than it is. Like, who comes up with that number? It's just like numbers pulled out of thin air. And I'm thinking, how? And inflation's not really going down. Okay, well, let's see if inflation's really going to tick down. Bottom line is, 4 out of the last 5 months, we've had the inflation numbers actually look bad. They're actually getting worse, not better. In January, we had a supposedly a 0.3% uptick for the month. Now, if you annualize that and times that looking forward at that rate for 12 months, that's a 3.6% rate increase if you just use simple interest, not compounding. If you compound, it's closer to about 4% rate of inflation, not a 2. Well, what nobody realizes is the following month and even the months after, they're going to revise those and correct them. So just a few weeks ago, and still in March, a week or two ago, we had the statistic people that kind of report all of our economic numbers say, oh, by the way, January, it really ticked up 0.4%, not 3. But who hears that? All they're looking forward to is, what's it going to be this month? What's it going to be this month? And even though they expect the producer price index and the CPI, the consumer price index, and or the cost index that where they take gas and food out, which they like the best. Why? Because gas and food is more volatile. Yeah, it's also one that affects more people. So they massage all these numbers and they report them in line with expectations. And by the way, 4 out of the last 5 months, they've been ticking up, not down. And every month they've revised them up, not down. So we know that there's BS. Inflation is not getting under control. And there's no reason or justification for dropping interest rates. So it didn't happen in March. And they go, well, that's because the economy is really good. I go, okay, so the economy is really good. Well, that's inflationary, supposedly, if we're creating all these jobs, which, by the way, get revised downwards. Like out of the last 14 months, 13 of them have been revised downward. In fact, you know, we've had quarterly revisions in the hundreds of thousands range. In fact, most of the revisions are in hundreds of thousands of jobs weren't created that we were told were created. So is the economy really in a robust growth situation or not? Is the GDP really growing based on government spending or not? Are these jobs government jobs, or are they just green cards handed off to some illegal alien that automatically claims asylum and gets a green card, a work permit? And so because they have money on a credit card, are they considered jobs? I don't know. I know that the economy is not growing like they say it is. More people are suffering than they say are. Less people have jobs. And if they are creating jobs, it's probably because there's 8.7 million workers that have to have two jobs to make ends meet. And that's the highest it's ever been. Mm-hmm. Credit card defaults, bankruptcies, all these things are at unprecedented, never seen before levels. But the economy is just floating right along just fine. And Powell has the audacity last week to say, well, we might not be able to cut rates quite as soon. In fact, we don't need to, because based on how strong the labor market is, and the fact that we're getting inflation under control, it's not. It's getting less under control every month. But because all these things supposedly are taking place, and he's just giving lip service and lying through his teeth, really, if you want to be blunt. Actually, he's just reading a script from the White House. We get that. There's an election coming up, and they don't want to rock the boats, and so they're just saying stuff to make everybody feel good. But it's fake. It's like, we might not have to lower interest rates after all because the economy is so good. So basically, Jerome Powell said this a week or two ago, and nobody's taken stock in what's really being said here. Well, maybe they are now because we're seeing some softening in the market as we start the fourth quarter, some pretty good down days so far. I think people are finally realizing, wait a minute. 3 weeks ago, we had like a 90% chance the Fed was still going to lower interest rates in June. Now it's less than 50% chance in just a couple of weeks. So even the odds makers and the bettors on the market are coming in saying, okay, well, maybe the truth is out. Maybe we're really not going to have rate cuts this year. Maybe we can't afford rate cuts. But what can they do if they don't cut rates? I mean, if they cut rates, inflation goes way out of control and the middle class suffers even worse. If they raise rates, the market tumbles, and that doesn't look good for the election. Not to mention all the people that have savings in 401ks and retirees that are still betting on the market to supply their income, which I think is a little bit crazy to do anyway. But there's all these issues that the Fed is kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. So they're just saying what they can to get us to the next Fed meeting. And if they can keep kicking that can down the road and get us to each next Fed meeting by not lowering interest rates, by saying, oh, but we think we might, or, well, we think we don't have to because the economy is so good. Gee, look at the market. You should keep buying the market. Well, the market and the economy are not going hand in hand. The economy's not good. The market is being manipulated by a handful of stocks and a handful of buyers, which are getting money from the Fed in the context of bank bailout money or the bank term funding program that started last year that was supposed to end in March of this year, but they gave it an extension probably because they didn't want, the market to sell off. Now, interestingly, after all this market buying happened by, banks and bank presidents, you see people like Jamie Dimon selling, was it $150 million in stock? I think it was the number. Anyway, sold a lot of his own stock after it appreciated, very significantly last year. And then just right after he sells stock, within a couple of weeks, he said, don't be surprised if we see a market correction, a really significant market correction, kind of a surprise market correction anytime soon. Well, he might just be warning the public that his company, JP Morgan Chase, is going to start selling off stock to either raise profits so they can, get out of some of the trouble and the loans that they've taken essentially from the Fed for, this bank bailout program, which has been taking place kind of behind the scenes. Yeah, the first bank to start selling is going to cause the other banks. And when I say banks, I mean broker dealers, the big brokerage firms, start selling. If they start selling, it's going to drop so fast, nobody's going to be able to get out of the way. In fact, they shut down trading when the market, gets hit really hard and there's a boatload of selling, basically. And if there's more than one market maker trying to sell and get out of positions and take profits on things like NVIDIA or their own stock that they've already ran up through the roof and they want to take some profits and, bank those from trading, they're going to have to sell eventually. So bottom line is there's some shenanigans happening. I think the Fed's been BSing us the whole time. They're finally admitting it, I think, saying, now it's because the economy's so good. Really? Ask my kids that who had to take a second job. Right. Ask any of those people that can't buy food without using their credit card and then can't pay their credit card off. Ask those people who are trying to downsize their rent because they can't afford the house that they've rented for the last 5 years and they just jack rent up 30% or 40% because they're trying to keep up with the inflation and the variable rate mortgages the investors have and all this stuff. So there's just a lot of stuff going down that I think we're getting a lot of misinformation. I wish we didn't. There's not a lot of fundamentals underlying the market run-up. And I do believe, as I've said for a long time, that we're more due for a correction than due for a continued bull market. Because it's an election year, I think they'll do what they can to minimize the problems of that from happening. But I think the market can still overrule or override their efforts eventually. And it may do that. So I would rather err on the side of caution than be careless and be foolish and be caught in the middle of a downturn with all my money if I need it to live on, especially if I'm retired. So again, wherever you are in the context of this stuff, if you're just starting out, man, we hope there's a crash because you can buy low.
Right.
If we're retired and have a bunch of money that we want to live on for the next 30 years, you probably don't want to lose 20 or 30 or even 10% of it. So be careful with how much you have at risk. But I think there's a lot of risk on the horizon. I think the Fed is finally coming clean with the fact that they're not going to be able to lower interest rates and the fact that inflation really is not getting under control. And maybe the economy is not as robust as they claim.
Jeff, I'm looking at a headline right now as we talk, and it says Fundstrat's Tom Lee says the Fed's first rate cut is still on pace for June with inflation dropping like a rock. I mean, quote, dropping like a rock. Well, I also looked at the inflation rate, and it says 3.09% last month, 3.15% this month. There seems to be some disagreement about where inflation goes. So anyway, we're talking with Jeff Logan of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management here in Tucson and also up in Mesa. We have been talking about current events, inflation, and whether or not the first rate cut is on pace for June. And we're going to get back to our conversation in just a moment and continue a conversation that we had last week about mistakes that people make getting into retirement. But before we do that, I want to remind you that if you'd like to get in and sit down with Jeff and talk about your individual situation, your path towards a confident retirement. Of course, Jeff is offering a no-cost, no-obligation retirement roadmap. It's not going to cost you a dime. To get yours, you can call this weekend 520-780-9059. 520-780-9059. It is an opportunity to sit down with Jeff on a one-on-one basis and ask the questions that you need to have answered. Once again, no cost and no obligation for this whatsoever. We do call it our retirement roadmap. Again, that telephone number with no cost, 520-780-9059. You can also request it online at primret.com, PREMRET.com. Jeff, last week we were talking about costly mistakes that people make at the beginning of retirement, and obviously there were so many of them that we didn't have a chance to finish that conversation. So some of the mistakes that we talked about last week, relocating, downsizing your home, planning to work into your retirement years, taking Social Security benefits too early, claiming Social Security early, and continuing to work and carrying debt. And again, if you want to hear that conversation, our show is also a podcast. Go to wherever you get your podcast, search for Premier Retirement with Jeff Hogan, and you'll find that conversation about these costly mistakes. Jeff, let's continue our conversation this week by talking about these costly mistakes, and we're up to the next one, which is not using home equity as an income source. Is that a mistake or not, do you think?
Well, you know, every answer is going to be an it depends situation, but I think a lot of people are, you know, have a nice home. Maybe they're really excited about paying it off before they retire. And the fact is you've got a lot of investment capital in that house. And the good of that is you don't have a mortgage payment eating into your cash flow. And that's great. And you do have a growth rate on the value of your home, hypothetically. And, you know, over history, maybe a 3% rate of return is probably the average growth rate on a home, even though lately it's been a lot higher than that. Yeah, there's been periods of time when real estate actually went backwards for a little bit. But let's say it makes 3%-ish, you know, kind of keeps up with inflation from the standpoint of, you know, considering that that is a storage of an asset, even though it's not liquid readily, it is an asset. Now, some people, you know, penny pinch and, you know, are so bent on paying off their house that they don't have enough extra money to, you know, have fun. My opinion is, are you really that focused on having a house you can leave your kids that's free and clear, or having a house that you might have to sell anyway later to move into a care facility or to a, you know, an assisted living community or even to a nursing home, you know, eventually? Now, some people are using the equity in their home as kind of their plan for their ace in the hole if they do need long-term care, where they can either do a reverse mortgage and raise some cash, or, you know, if you don't have heirs or your heirs are doing just fine on their own, why not use the equity? You can do a reverse mortgage. Yeah, you pay interest on some of the money that you pull out, but you get to use the equity. So you basically use your own equity and they take it out of the growth or the equity of whatever's left in the house when you pass away. So there are ways to maximize your cash flow if that's what you're looking forward to doing. I am not opposed at the idea of reverse mortgages. So many people have, I think a lot of people have made some mistakes on how they explain why they are invented and what they do or what they can do. But there's a lot of options that people can benefit, you know, by having a reverse mortgage. They can't, you know, as long as you keep the house up, you don't trash it. I mean, they can't really take the house away from you. I guess, you know, if they're going to loan you money against it and you practically burn it down, you know, the bank that loans you the money does a reverse mortgage isn't going to be happy. So there are some qualifications, but most people do take care of their house because they love the house and that's where they want to age in place. So, you know, don't overlook it. I think sometimes people penny pitch and don't have any fun during the go-go years because they got this big old house paid for that they could have maybe used some of the equity or even kept the mortgage on it for a little while and paid it down over time and had a little bit more money in their investments that could have grown maybe more than the 3 or 4% their average house value would have grown. And you could have used kind of like, I've used the word before, arbitrage, where, you know, instead of paying off your house, you make more money by using the money to either create an income stream or to live on. You know, some annuity companies will pay you more than the interest rate on your house if you look at the cash flow, the net cash flow of what you would pay on your house as opposed to what you would get on the same amount of money that you'd use by paying off your house. So again, what's your net cash flow? It's what you keep that matters. It's the lifestyle you get to live that matters. And just having a paid off house, if it gives you the peace of mind that you need, then great, have it, do that. But, you know, my opinion, I have properties and most of my properties are actually, I have loans on them because I reloan that money out to other people at higher interest for their houses because they can't qualify for a good loan through a bank. So because I have good credit, I get to arbitrage my my credit by borrowing at a low rate and loaning it back out on a high rate. And I still have security of real estate. So there's a lot of games you can play. And that's just, you know, what I'm saying. My particular one is, but that doesn't mean you have to have that same philosophy or that same value system, but don't overlook the fact that you may have more options because you have home equity than you would have if you didn't have home equity.
And don't forget also that the interest on a home equity loan or line of credit is also tax deductible, so don't forget to consider your home equity as part of your retirement planning. Our next costly mistake that sometimes people make getting into retirement, Jeff, is going to be not planning for long-term care. Now, I think hands down, that indeed is a mistake.
Well, long-term care is probably your second biggest probability of after dying and paying taxes. Actually, I guess that would be third. I mean, the only things you have to do is die and pay taxes, but about 50% of the people end up in some sort of a nursing home situation. I don't believe that preparing for nursing home means buying a nursing home policy from one of these carriers that keep jacking up your rate until it's so expensive you end up dropping it in your 80s and you end up not having long-term care anyway when you die. I don't like pay-as-you-go policies. I don't like the use-it-or-lose-it type programs. There are asset-based programs where you can park money, and I like using LERPs for this, the life insurance version of a retirement plan, where you can park money in a life insurance shell tax-free. It grows tax-free. You can borrow against it tax-free, and there's a death benefit that you have to buy just to play the game, basically is the trick you use to, you know, get away with this tax game you're playing with the IRS code, and you have to buy a little bit of insurance. Why not use that insurance? If you buy the right policy, they will allow that death benefit to be available to you if you go to a nursing home early, so you don't have to die to get it. You basically get to spend your death benefit while you're alive. Either you can borrow against it to spend, or you can actually spend it for long-term care, terminal illness, or those final expenses that you get even before death. People don't know that. Sometimes people think life insurance is really just death insurance, but it isn't. It really can be life insurance if you use all the living benefits of a plan. The other thing is, you know, long-term care doesn't have to be a purchase, even an insurance product. It could just be, I've got this money set aside that, you know, is going to continue to grow. Maybe it's an HSA account that you ended up with $60,000 or $70,000 in when you were 62 years old and you retired, you know, from your company, and you just let that compound annually. And maybe by the time you're, you know, 85 or 90 years old, it's worth $400,000. Well, maybe that can be your, it's kind of like a retirement savings plan for healthcare, and you don't have to take required minimum distributions out when you're 73. You can actually die with it and pass on to your heirs, or you can actually spend it if you want to treat it like taxable income, like an IRA, or you can use it for those healthcare matters if you get to that point and you need them for that type of program. The other thing you can do is, like we just said, use your home equity as your ace. You know, maybe your house is worth $500,000 right now, but, you know, in 20 or 30 years, it'll probably be worth $1 million or more. By that time, you'll have it paid off if you don't already. Yeah, you can always downsize. You can always do a reverse mortgage and take some money out that would cover that long-term care. I mean, if you borrowed half that money against it, a $1 million house would be $500,000. I think $500,000, even 20 years from now, would probably cover you for a few years in a nursing home. You know, you add your Social Security and other assets to that, you should be okay. So I am not a firm believer in pay-as-you-go policies. I know that probably hurts the feelings of anybody listening who actually sells long-term care policies, the pay-as-you-go, let's get a commission every month and a renewal type thing for their livelihood. But honestly, I don't see it benefiting enough of my clients to where it makes a lot of sense to have a long-term care pay-as-you-go policy and, you know, have the company jack rates up until you can't afford them anymore and have you not even have the potential of not having it in the future. Now, there are some people that don't have savings, that can't get life insurance, that have really a bunch of cash flow that may actually benefit by those policies. So I'm not saying that they're not relevant. I'm just saying that that's probably not one of my first three or four choices as to how to fund long-term care. It would be kind of a backup plan if none of the others would work.
Costly mistakes that people make just before retirement. That's what we're talking about with Jeff Hogan of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management in Tucson and Mesa. And Jeff, we're going to take a break. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment after listener questions. Once again, if you've got questions about our program or you'd like to sit down with Jeff and get your complimentary Premier Retirement review, call 520-780-9059. No cost and no obligation. Jeff, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more of Premier Retirement right after this on 790 KNST. Tucson's most stimulating talk.
You can't start a trip you've never taken without a plan, and you can't start your retirement journey without a comprehensive plan to get there safely. To request your no-cost Premier Retirement Roadmap, call 580-780-9059 or request it online at premret.com. Now back to more Premier Retirement with Jeff Hogan and Jeff Shade.
We so appreciate you listening here for the Premier Retirement Show on 790 KNST. We're on the air for you four times a week, and those four times would be Saturday mornings at 7 a.m., also 9 a.m. and 1 p.m. We're also on the air on Sundays at 11 a.m., and as always, if you've missed any part of the program, be sure to join us on our podcast. You can hear all of our past shows there. Go to wherever you get your podcast, search for Premier Retirement with Jeff Hogan. You'll find this show and, as I said, all of our past shows, so you can stay on top of your journey towards a confident retirement. Okay, Jeff, we've got some listener questions this week. We'll start off with Barry, who's listening to us in Oro Valley. And Barry writes, I received a message about Roth conversion saying funds can't be withdrawn without penalty within 5 years of the conversion. And if you convert your IRA to a Roth gradually over time, those conversions each trigger the five-year rule for that portion of the money. I thought I heard you once say that if you establish a Roth account, you start counting the 5 years and later contributions do not reset the five-year rule. Can you clarify?
Well, I've been doing this a long time and I have not seen a situation. Here's the, let me just back. If you establish a Roth IRA, depending on your age, and you didn't tell me how old you are, if you're pre-59 and a half, you can't pull any Roth money pre-59 and a half out without a penalty anyway. It goes the same as that 10% penalty with the pre-59 and a half withdrawals from a regular IRA. Assuming you're over 59 and a half and you have access without tax penalty to those funds, if you convert to a Roth, let's say right now, today, anytime after today, you can pull the principal you've already paid tax out without penalty. The only thing you can't pull out is the gains on that contribution. So as far as any Roth goes, most people continue to add to the Roth every year or do a partial conversions every year. The Roth account could be one account that you have at Fidelity or Vanguard or wherever, and you just keep adding to it. Once it's 5 years old, then there's no restrictions as to what part of the money you can pull out, principal or interest. Now, if you set up multiple Roths, the company you set them up with may not know you have a Roth someplace. And so they may just say, hey, this is the five-year rule, and you might have to make some adjustments to the way you account for it. But once you establish a Roth, you are a Roth owner. Once you're a Roth owner, you can continue to add to Roth. You can build different accounts anywhere you want to, and it is still considered your Roth because it's still all under your Social Security number, period. So it is still like one Roth with a bunch of different sub-accounts in it, just like you could have a 401k and six different funds in it. You can have a Roth with six different account numbers at six different institutions, but it's still your Roth. So again, the rule applies as if it's one big Roth. I have never been corrected on this. We've used it for several years and not been called out on it. So not only have I, seen and adhered to this based on my understanding of the law, it has served its purpose and worked this way as well. So I don't know why that each contribution would trigger a five-year rule. I've heard people that have suggested that or been told that, but it has not worked that way in my experience. So I'm not a tax attorney and I'm not the IRS. So if they have a different rule and we've just been getting away with it, then I guess that's one thing. But I'm pretty good at the retirement planning business. And I've never seen it work that way. I've only seen it work. The five-year clock ticks right away. And again, if you only pull out the principal that you put in that you've already paid taxes on, there's no penalty even if you don't wait 5 years. So again, depending on what you want to do, are you trying to put the money in and take it out in year four and or in year six, but the money you put in last year, can't be coming out because you just barely put it in? Are you really going to deplete it down to zero? I guess it would only matter if you were going to take out all the gains as well and deplete the account. I don't know that I've seen that situation occur where we would do that. because once you put it in a Roth, the whole reason is to leave it in there tax-free and let it build as much and as long as you can. But if you do need a little bit of it here and there, it really shouldn't affect you because you can always pull out the principal. So not sure where the miscommunication came from, or hope that clarified it, but that's my understanding and that's how it's worked for us.
Barry, we appreciate you listening to us in Oro Valley. And of course, we will send you out Jeff's book, Retirement, The Road Ahead. Okay, Jeff, next question, rather simple, from Joe in Tucson. And Joe says, what is the tax impact and lost investment income of waiting to take Social Security till I'm 70? I'm 62 right now.
Well, that is a big, it depends question, Joe. What I like to do, and this kind of goes back to the process that we do here at Premier Retirement, is we build a Premier Retirement Roadmap, and we build a scenario. It's on a spreadsheet that would take into account the next 30 years or so of your life, maybe 40 because you're 62 now. So we like to build it out to age 100 and say, what happens if you start your Social Security now? And what happens if we can assume a rate of return of X? What happens if we take the Social Security now and don't spend down our IRA? Or maybe we take our Social Security now and live on that money, or we use it to pay taxes on Roth conversions so we can get tax-free money later. If that's the case, then the tax ramifications would be really good because you're doing Roth conversions in conjunction with taking the Social Security early. If it means taking Social Security late and that's your only source of income, but you have just enough money to get you to 70, but you'll have a bigger Social Security paycheck, 15% of which will be tax-free because that's the way the tax code is. Right now, you only pay tax on up to 85% of your Social Security. But if that's your only source of income, maybe you don't even have to pay taxes on it at all because you might not hit the provisional income limits. The other thing is if it means spending down all your savings and investment income just to get a higher paycheck when you're 70, I think that would be a foolish idea. If you have so much money in 401ks and IRAs that you need to really hurry up and live on some of it, spend it down, have a lot of fun to draw the millions of tax-deferred money down to less millions, so that you're in a less of a hurtful tax situation at age 70, it might be smarter to at least have 15% of a bigger paycheck at age 70 be tax-free and not have as big a required minimum distributions coming out of those IRAs when you could have done Roth conversions earlier. So in the context of that question, it's a very simple question, but it's only one tiny piece that would fill one or two cells on a spreadsheet with hundreds of cells that would show us the story of what happens if you take it early as opposed to taking it late. What are your taxes now as opposed to taxes later? Does it make sense to spend more of your IRA or use more of your IRA now instead of Social Security? And then there's the old question is, you know, what do you think Social Security is going to do in the future? The trust fund's going broke, and in 2033, it looks like it's going to be out of money, and there'll be less money coming in than it takes to pay everybody on Social Security. Are you going to be in a position where you're going to be considered the rich guy they want to adjust your Social Security payouts to? Because I think it will be means tested. That's my personal opinion. It's not, you know, signed into law yet, but that's kind of how the government looks at things. It's means tested. Oh, the rich people have to take a cut. The little old lady who lives in a shoe is not going to be able to do much, so we can't cut her Social Security 25%, but we can cut the rich guy's 50% to make up the difference, you know, or whatever. So again, there might be some other things that are value driven or maybe policy driven that you believe will happen based on politics and who's in power, who may be in power, or the things that could happen down the road that might make you take a different approach to basically putting more things in place right now that are secure, predictable, or even guaranteed rather than the what ifs of Social Security in the future.
Joe, thanks for that question. Thanks for listening to us in Tucson. And of course, we will be sending you out Jeff's book, Retirement, The Road Ahead. Next question, Jeff, is Dan listening to us in Green Valley, and Dan writes, I have a question about when it makes sense to purchase an annuity. I'm a single 67-year-old man planning to retire in the next year. I currently have a small pension, a 401k, and other investments and savings. I'm considering putting some of my funds in an annuity. The annuity would actually pay more than my 401k if considering the recommended 3 to 3.5% annual withdrawal. I like the security of knowing I would have this guaranteed income for the rest of my life. I'm not worried about leaving money to anyone after I die. I have no children. My family and friends are all doing well financially. But when I read about annuities, there seems to be few financial advisors who recommend this option. Does an annuity make sense for me?
Well, most financial advisors who call themselves financial advisors work for a company owned by a Wall Street company or bank, right? So they don't sell annuities. They sell stocks, bonds, and cash. They want to get fees over and over again on the same money. That's their business model. So they hate annuities. Annuities are counterproductive to their model. They would rather get fees and hope you grow your assets and, you know, just kind of go cha-ching, cha-ching for the rest of your life. Typically, annuities, the people that sell annuities, if they're insurance licensed only, either get, you know, one commission up front one time and they never get paid again, or they get a small trailer, which is typically less than what the Wall Street firm would charge you in fees, even less than most mutual fund would charge in, you know, admin fees, just like, you know, even in addition to, you know, loads and expenses charged, operation expenses of the mutual fund itself. So I don't think it's a big moneymaker for Wall Street. That's probably why they would prefer that you not get into that. However, I think as a comprehensive plan, it makes total sense. And you'll find that a lot of fiduciaries, you say the few financial advisors that do recommend it, you say there's only a few. That's true. And they're typically the independents like myself who use most of the disciplines or most of the tools that are out there for a comprehensive plan. I don't think a comprehensive plan is stocks, bonds, and cash. I mean, that might get you to retirement just fine because you've got a paycheck. Well, who replaces the paycheck when you're in retirement? If the stock market averages 10 and the bond market averages 5 or 6 over the last 100 years, why are you only allowed to take 3 to 3.5% as the recommended annual withdrawal rate? Well, that's because of volatility. If you can take volatility out of it, you're correct. An annuity pays a lot more, like maybe a 7 or 8% rate of return or a rate of withdrawal out of that and guaranteed not to run out of money. And the cool thing is, if you do run out of money, the insurance company will pick up the risk. And if you live to 115 years old and the account runs dry at age 90, they'll continue to pay you till you're 115. Now, some annuities would also penalize if you die early. Let's say you are taking 7 or 8% of your money out every year and you only live 10 years and you only got 70 or 80% of your money back. And there's 30% left on the table. Well, that money would either go to the annuity company to pay for the people that live too long, or you could do it a different way, which I like better. And that is buy an annuity that still allows you to keep ownership and control of the principal, yet have a company that would guarantee you because they know how much they believe they can make on your money and still come out and pay you a decent rate of return and still come out ahead on their end, where they could guarantee you a withdrawal rate of, let's say, 6 or 7%. But if something happens along the way where you just don't want the income anymore, maybe you get sick, you just want to have one last, you know, going away party and bring all your friends on a world cruise or whatever and rent the whole boat and you want to spend it all, you can cash it in and take it and spend it all. You don't need that income for another 20 years because you're not going to live another 20 years potentially. So again, if you want to take control of that, and the other thing is even though you don't have heirs that you at least listing here that you want to leave anything to, if there was anything left, you could direct it to go to a charity, a church, or any special cause that you would want to if you don't run the account dry. Now, if you live a long time, you can still run that account down to zero and still get that income for life. I like the indexed annuity, which, you know, is safer, pays good returns, and companies are willing to offer a higher income guaranteed payout rate than on variables and other fixed annuities that have a low fixed interest rate as opposed to, you know, a variable, which has a lot of risk and the companies are a little bit worried about taking on that risk and those extra expenses and guaranteeing you a higher income. So if you look for an income paying annuity that's not like the old school annuities where, you know, it's just a flat payment and you can't access the cash, look at an indexed annuity, look at a fixed index annuity. That fixed means safe. Index means it goes up based on indexes, doesn't go down. That's why fixed means safe. And the insurance companies can guarantee a withdrawal rate or an income rate that you can live on that is guaranteed to be X or higher without you running out of money and you still have complete control of that account.
Dan, thanks for that question and, of course, for listening to us in Green Valley. And your book, Retirement the Road Ahead, is on its way to you. If you have a question you'd like us to answer on the air, very simple to get it to us. Simply go to our website, which is premret.com, P-R-E-M-R-E-T.com. Send us your question from the contact page there. And, of course, if we use it on the air, we'll be sending you out Jeff's book, Retirement the Road Ahead. You're listening to Premier Retirement with Jeff Ogan. My name's Jeff Shade. Glad you could join us here for our show. We're on every week for you for your fiscal fitness and your financial education right here on 790 KNST Tucson's most stimulating talk. Also want to remind you that if you'd like to sit down with Jeff and have a private conversation about your journey towards a confident retirement, we're offering this consultation at no cost, no obligation, certainly no judgment. To get yours, call 520-780-9059. I know it may be the weekend that you're listening to us right now, but go ahead, give that call today, 520-780-9059. All you've got to do is leave your name and telephone number. Shelley will call you back during the week and set you up with an appointment with Jeff so you can get your questions answered so that you don't make mistakes that you may not be able to recover from. Once again, no cost, no obligation for this. Not going to cost you a dime and no judgment. 520-780-9059 or online at premret.com, P-R-E-M-R-E-T.com. Okay, Jeff, for the past couple of weeks, we've been talking about costly mistakes that people make at the beginning of retirement. And let's get back to our topic right now. The next one on the list is a lack of estate planning documents. Now, if you die without any estate planning documents, Jeff, I guess that's called dying intestate. And that means that the government will decide who gets your stuff, right?
Well, there is. There's called an intestate succession rule, which is basically, you know, codified in the state that you live in under their laws, right? There's a certain way that assets will be distributed. However, people have to show up at probate court. There's usually people assigned to represent your estate. Somebody will represent the court. Lawyers love to get paid by the hour, so they never like to do these processes very quickly. And I'm not trying to besmirch the names of all lawyers, but I mean, the business model is not really conducive to expeditious settlement of an estate, let's just say. So, you know, a will, a lot of people say, oh, well, then I need a will. Well, that's, that doesn't mean you die intestate, but the will still has to be read in court in a public place. There has to be people given a chance to come and contest the will or say, no, I believe I should have been, you know, I was a spouse, I should have been legally entitled to some of that. And that's true. The succession rules of a state would override whatever you put in a will, unless the people in the will are, you know, agree to go along with it. Again, a will is just really a court document that still has to be proven in court. And that's actually what probate means, is prove in court. Probate is proving something during that court process. So a will is, in my opinion, not the right document. There's two ways to get out of probate and out of that rigmarole of dying and leaving your heirs, you know, having to fight and grovel with government agencies to get your stuff. I mean, it's bad enough they have to fight and grovel with the company, the insurance company, to get their insurance, or contact Fidelity to get your account money from your brokerage accounts transferred to them, or whatever. It's kind of a pain in the butt anyway. Why complicate it with a court process and a bunch of lawyers and judges and waiting 2 or 3 years sometimes just to get your time in court to say, hey, is this stuff really going to be mine yet or not? So you can either do a living trust, which basically puts the control in your hands while you're alive, passes that control on your children when you pass away or become incapacitated, or I would just say children or any heirs. It could be your brother, sister, neighbor, depending on who you trust to be the trustee of that trust. Now, a trust means you're trusting that person to be every bit as accurate in how your assets are distributed and managed as you would manage them yourself. That's why I think I would trust a friend or a family member probably more than I would trust somebody in court that doesn't know me and doesn't have any, you know, interest in my family or my, you know, well-being, or, you know, what happens to my money, really, other than what they think they're being told based on a will document. So again, go with a trust, and it basically hands off the powers to somebody that you trust to be in charge of your stuff when you die or become incapacitated. The other way is just to put beneficiaries, direct beneficiaries, on everything you own. You can put a beneficiary on a house in Arizona now. That is an estate planning document. A beneficiary deed is an estate planning document, because what? It tells where your house goes as soon as you're dead. You can put your children's names on there, your heirs' names on there, and as soon as you die, they produce a death certificate and they can sell the house, move into the house, or transfer the ownership to them by title and deed and record it. You can do that, a pay on death account at a bank. You can do an in trust for or pay on death document at your broker's. You can put a beneficiary on an IRA, on an insurance policy, on an annuity. And those beneficiaries take precedence over any court process possible. That is a direct succession document. So it kind of supersedes wills and trusts. And in my opinion, is probably the easiest way to pass your assets to who you want, how you want, when you want. However, there are some times when you have maybe 3 kids, one kid isn't very astute with money, you want that person's share to be paid out over a period of time, you want another person's share to be given to them directly because, you know, they have a lot of student debt they want to pay off, or whatever, or the other one needs to buy a house. So maybe you have different assets that end up in the trust that you want to be passed out or distributed in a different type of a timely manner. Maybe you want some kept in trust for grandchildren or college educations or a scholarship fund or something like that. You can do that in a trust by naming those desires and just basically articulating them in the trust document. So that way people know what your wishes were and they can carry those out, again, by you assigning a trustee to the cause. The trustee doesn't have to be overburdened. In fact, if it's a burdensome case, they are entitled to take compensation for their time, effort, no more than what a trust company would pay, which is a lot, by the way. But you can limit it to a certain either amount, or maybe it's an heir that's already inheriting some of the money and it's worth their time and effort just to make sure it's done efficiently with all the rest of the siblings or the other heirs. There's another thing I want to talk about estate planning documents people don't remember, and that is it's not just about death. There are what's called living probate documents. The living probate would be powers of attorney. What if you're not dead, but you are living in a nursing home and don't have the capacity to make financial decisions anymore? You don't want to lose your house or have assets taken from you because you can't file taxes, you can't sell stock, you can't buy stuff, you can't renew your CD at the bank, and you can't sign checks, and nobody's paying your bills because they're not all on auto pay, and all of a sudden, you know, they turn off your lights and then your house gets vandalized. And I mean, there could be all kinds of things that could happen where nobody could take care of your stuff and you're out of it. Well, powers of attorney will help that happen. Powers of attorney for healthcare, so somebody can tell the doctors what to do with you, medicate, treat, pull a plug when necessary, those kind of things. And then the financial power of attorney, the powers of attorney for financial and all other matters. That's who's going to make decisions for me when I can't make them for myself. Those are living probate documents. And even if you think, well, I don't need a will or a trust because I'm just going to list all my beneficiaries on there, you really ought to have the powers of attorney and also a living will that says, hey, doc, when I'm brain dead, pull the plug. Don't make me linger here forever just because you're getting paid from Medicare to keep me alive. You know, just, you know, let me die in dignity. There's that document that you can have as well. So again, powers of attorney. You might even want to have a backup will just in case something gets left out of your estate. We call that a pour over will. It's kind of a backup will, powers of attorney. And we call that just the ancillary documents of a trust or a portfolio. And if you don't have a will or a trust or don't need a will or a trust because you've handled those assets another way, then at least make sure you have the living probate documents that might serve you very well in those days between now and the time you do end up passing away.
Costly mistakes that people make at the beginning of retirement. That's what we're talking about with Jeff Hogan of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management. Jeff, our next one is being too conservative with investments.
Well, let me put that in context with being too conservative and being too risky. I can probably answer those both because I think they're both on the list here. Okay, being too conservative. I mean, if you're, you know, a few years ago when you could only make 2% in a CD and 0% on interest and bonds, it was really hard to base a retirement plan on 2%. Mm-hmm. Now, I think you can base a retirement plan on 5 or 6%. So now that interest rates are up higher, maybe we can, you know, be a little bit more conservative and get away with it. I also think that, you know, you can be overly exposed to risk because a 50% market correction that takes 6 or 8 years to get back to even while you're spending money could run you out of money a lot quicker than you anticipated. I often tell the story about Norm, who had $1 million in retirement in the 2000, right before the 2000 crash, decided to retire as an engineer at a big chip company up in Phoenix, ended up spending money while the market was crashing and asking his broker, "Hey, dude, I'm spending money. Is this going to be okay?" He goes, "Don't worry, Norm, the market always comes back." Well, guess what? It doesn't come back on the money you spend, especially money that is continually decreasing in value, where you have to spend more and more shares of your stocks in order to pay for the same cost of living as you paid for a year earlier when the stock market was twice as high as it is when you're, you know, spending it this year. So bottom line is, you know, he was down from $1 million down to about $250,000 in only 3 years because the market plummeted, but the market started coming back just to do what? You know, in 08, it crashed again. And so this guy had $1 million to retire on, kept it all at risk, and never recovered. He had to get some part-time jobs, had to take Social Security early, had to not travel, had to not golf, had to not do a lot of things that he had planned to do in retirement because, you know, he got the crap kicked out of him. That's, I don't know how to say it, you know, in the market. So again, could he have done better with a CD? Well, honestly, if he'd had everything in a 5 or 6% CD, that wouldn't have even been too conservative. However, you know, over the long haul, we'd like to have some safe money that can do better than, you know, 4 or 5% that you can live on during those downturns in the market so that you can wait on that money. So what Norm might wanted to do is have half his money at risk that he could have, you know, waited around for 5 or 10 years while he spent the other half. Now, that might only get his first half back to even, however, but at least you bought 10 years of time and you've got twice as much money as you would otherwise. Now, my opinion is you structure a plan where you don't just put some in safe money and use it, and you put some in risk money and don't use it, is you put money where you have kind of the best of both worlds, where you have principal protection, you have upside when the market does really well, no downside when the market doesn't do well. And you can do that in one account. Those index annuities that came out about the time Norm was retiring, and they were very new to the market, so it wasn't probably anybody out there other than me, if I'd have met him that early, to explain it to him, because I knew about them in the late 90s and was fascinated by them enough to try them out and was really glad I did when the market crashed in 2000. But Norm didn't have access to these. He didn't hear about them. But index annuities that go up when the market goes up but don't fall when the market goes down would have protected that $1 million and at least kept it at $1 million. But the companies also have what's called income guarantees. They can guarantee a certain payout of income, maybe at 6 or 7%. So it could have been maybe $60,000 or $70,000 if you used the whole $1 million. Probably wouldn't have used all of it. But let's just say you have a guaranteed income. Let's say you used enough to create $50,000 in income. Well, you add that with Social Security, he's back up to, you know, close to what he was taking home after his job. And he could have still had maybe $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 in the stock market to grow, and maybe by now it would have been worth $1 million again, right? So he'd have been having his income while he could still ride the, you know, roller coaster of the market and not worry about using that money, but yet still be in a position where if he wanted to buy a new house, or heaven forbid had to go to a nursing home or an Alzheimer's lockdown facility and had to pay his way because he wasn't able to afford insurance when he was losing his money early on. Bottom line is you never know when you might need that growth. You know, the stock market over the long term does keep up with inflation better than most other things. We want to get inflation down to the 2 or 3% range, or even the 2 is what they're targeting. You know, if we can keep interest rates above 2 or 3, even fixed interest rates keep up with inflation, but it doesn't allow you to spend down principal because, of course, low interest on less and less principal is going to be a track to run out of money. So you have to kind of find that balance between exposure to the market and interest rates. Right now we have higher interest rates, which means maybe you can, you know, get a little bit more exposure to the market in those principal protected accounts, which is actually a good thing. You can also get higher rates in CDs, but I don't know how long they'll hold out. We might not be able to bet on our safe money earning, you know, 4 or 5 or 6% for the rest of your retirement life. It'll probably go back down to where they want it to go eventually. So again, structure your plan. Right now is a great opportunity to kind of rebalance your risk I think the market's a little overvalued. I don't think it's a great time to go all in when the market's at unprecedented highs and the economy, the economic indicators are going down and the fundamentals of most normal stock valuations are not in our favor. It may not be a good time to be overexposed to the market. It may be a time to kind of reduce that exposure, maybe try out some of these other principal protected assets that, if I'm wrong, the market continues to go up, you still make money and you're not locked into low interest rates. And if I'm right, you don't lose money.
We're talking about costly mistakes that people make at the beginning of retirement with Jeff Hogan of Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management. And Jeff, unfortunately, we're out of time for this week. I want to remind our listeners, 520-780-9059 is our telephone number. If you'd like to have a consultation with Jeff about your individual journey, 520-780-9059. Well, as I said, Jeff, we're out of time for this week. I want to thank you for your time, but most of all, I want to thank our fine listeners here in the Tucson area for joining us. For Jeff Hogan, I'm Jeff Shade. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again next week with another edition of Premier Retirement right here on 790 KNST, Tucson's most stimulating talk.
Investment advisory services provided through Premier Wealth Advisors, LLC, an Arizona State Registered Investment Advisor. Securities transactions are placed through TD Ameritrade. Insurance and annuity products are offered through Premier Advantage, Inc., DBA Premier Retirement Planning and Wealth Management. Investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Any reference to protection, safety, or lifetime income generally refer to fixed insurance products. Insurance guarantees are backed by the financial strength and claims paying abilities of the insurance carrier. The show is intended for informational purposes only and is not to be construed as advice or recommendations. Due to show format, accuracy, and completeness cannot be guaranteed. Premier Retirement and its representatives do not provide legal or tax advice and may only conduct business with residents of states and jurisdictions where they're properly registered.